Good morning. We're live in Studio A. I'm Gretchen Gondek, your host for a very special edition of Opus today. And joining me in studio is music director and conductor Ryan Haskins of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. Good morning, maestro.
Good morning. Great to be here, Gretchen.
We have a super, super special guest, and probably for me today, the interview of a lifetime. Zuul Bailey, the cellist, is here in Studio A. Good morning,
Zuul.
You
make me blush. Thank you for saying such nice things. It's a great way to start the morning. Thank you.
I know you have an extremely busy schedule, so we really appreciate you squeezing in a little bit of time to be here today. I have to say, on a personal note, how much I enjoyed your performance of the Elgar Cello Concerto a year ago, September, and the raw emotion of the concerto and your interpretation and performance were absolutely fabulous. I'd never heard the concerto perform live, but I was thinking of Jacqueline Dupre and how very pleased she would have been had she been there.
This is a piece that I actually try not to teach to young people because technically it's accessible, but emotionally it's completely overwhelming. Obviously, people can play it, but this reminds me of this story that Rostropovich heard me play when I was in my teens, the great Russian cellist, and he said, "Congratulations, you can play the cello. Now go get a life so people will care." And what that meant, basically, is that these pieces, why it's so they're impacting, why they're programmed and enjoyed by conductors, it's orchestras, soloists alike, is that it's such a deep meaning and a feeling. There's that saying, it's not what you do, it's how you make people feel. That piece, with a few others, make me feel things every time I play them that I've never felt before based on where I am in my life. And I think it does for the audience as well.
And you have come back to Siouxland. We're so thrilled that you're here again. And I know Ryan and you have done quite a lot of outreach and engagement with the community, and that isn't something all artists are willing to do.
We discussed this last time. This is why I'm in music. People came to my schools. They took time to come out and make music accessible in my childhood, and it was in Washington, D.C., and I thought that that was normal. It was maybe normal for there at that time, but most cities, it takes great leadership as your maestro here to put that in place and to make it a priority. And so I began my travels at 19, and I begged to go in the community. I couldn't stand just sitting in hotel rooms waiting for that 25 minutes on stage. I wanted to meet people, and what I started realizing, which is beyond the sowing the seeds and our future, but so let's just say you play for 2,000 people that one night in the concert hall. I do reach 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 people in any given week on top of that. So to walk away feeling like I've done everything I can to rally a community or help assist a community, that's a huge inspiration to me.
And that's the brilliant part about, what we do here in Sioux City. A great artist is a great artist. And everyone may think that one single layer of that is the talent or the ability to perform. But there's so much more beyond that. And it's something that we're so aware of and pay close attention to when we bring artists here, especially here in Sioux City. And we're overjoyed that partnership, certainly with Zuul, but with many of our guest artists, has continued to be all about that outreach aspect, because that's really what makes the music come to life. Yes, you have the concerto, you have the 30 minutes or the 2-hour concert or whatever, but to connect that into the community and to allow people to be able to experience that music in different ways and actually have it affect their lives, you have to be in the community. You have to have that outreach and that communication back and forth, because music is about life. And if we're not living with the music or living in with the community, there's really no point to what we're doing. So that's the brilliant part of having people, amazing people like Zuul here in town. It's sort of our hearts beat together when we're in this
and
mode.
It's because of Ryan's example last time that I'm back. I mean, this is it was very personal last time, and I felt what he was doing with the community. And so when it was approached for me to do the special visit, I couldn't believe that I was available, and I really wanted to make it happen. I felt very lucky and blessed that it was fate.
And Saturday night, which is tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Orpheum Theater, a great favorite on the symphony schedule, and that is the holiday, annual holiday concert. Can you give us a preview?
Yeah, Christmas with the Symphony can, in this is a very complex sort of, probably much more than we want to think about for Christmas with the Symphony concert, but the programming aspect is, I think, in some parts the easiest to sort of bring together and create and mold, but it also brings additional challenges that I don't experience with programs like the Elgar or what we had earlier in the season with Beethoven and Debussy. Because in this type of program, you know, we don't print a program for the audience, which I think is great. Because no one knows what's about to happen.
That's great.
Hopefully we do, right?
That's great.
but the exciting part of this is that it sort of keeps everyone on the edge of their seat. And because of that, the challenges on the presenting side are complex in that the pacing becomes that much more important. And the tempo, not just of the music, but of the program, which adds into the success. You know, it's a fully produced, fully scripted kind of program, but we're able to perform, you know, remarkable works with great artists and feature, you know, carols and traditional tunes and something that also appeals to sort of a younger generation as well. So it's this sort of fantastic recipe of all of these elements put into one pot. And it's one of our most successful sort of, presentations out of the entire year, and it's so much fun.
And obviously, we'll be hearing Zuhl tomorrow night. Are you able to tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear?
I don't know.
Or is it more of a surprise?
Do we want to talk about it? We haven't discussed this.
One thing that we could maybe allude to if I do show up.
Yes, we still haven't promised that. His picture's on the poster.
Oh, is it really? Okay, I'll finally be there. Is that you're going to be that? What I love about the cello is the fact that it's the most like the human voice. It's a storytelling instrument. It's very soothing and healing. And my hope is, if he invites me to the stage, that I will be able to share a moment of reflection. And also kind of the breadth of the holidays and the breadth of what it represents, bringing us together in a way that I think only a cello or a human voice can spin.
And I think, you know, going just a step further before we reveal what it is, you know, the work that we'll tell you about tomorrow night is perhaps not thought of something performed around this time of year, which is also fascinating. But I think the work itself envelops a lot of life aspects and all of this sort of, you know, we're talking about out in the community and what music does for the person. This work tells a story, and it sort of usually is performed at maybe a different time of year. But I think also that's another reason why it should be performed at this time of year, because this holiday season, regardless of what your background is or, you know, what religion you are or whatever it is, this is a special time of year, but this special time of year means something because of what comes, right? How the year sort of moves through one's life, and then it circles back mm-hmm. to December again. So, I mean... I think that's all I'm going to give. It's probably very confusing, but
it'll be very clear.
It will be very clear
when it's clear.
It will
when it's cleared up.
But it'll be very touching, and I can't think of anyone who can express, the emotional playing and communicative playing more than Zuhl to present this piece with us. So I think it's a perfect match.
And we know this concert is very popular. A lot of people have purchased their tickets. We would recommend that you do that before 7:30 on Saturday night. You can line up and hope to get a ticket tomorrow evening, but we would encourage you to call the symphony office.
Yes, absolutely. Call the office and grab the tickets. We also, of course, need to mention that we are doing a pre-concert concert on the Mighty Wurlitzer organ. How many times have you been, Zuhl, on a program with the Mighty Wurlitzer organ? Probably never before. But here in Sioux City, you are going to have that experience. It's an incredible instrument. You know, when I first came to Sioux City, you get introduced to all the things and you sort of glaze over after a while because it's just overwhelming and all the people you have to meet. But gosh, that first introduction to that instrument, I was a bit overwhelmed, but what it can do is incredible. I mean, it has an entire orchestra up in the lofts. Maybe sometime we get a camera up there so people can actually see it functioning. Can I make that happen for tomorrow night? Probably not. But anyway, it's a very cool instrument, and Rick Darrow is fantastic on the instrument, so we'll have him featured at 6:45, and then, of course, concert begins at 7:30.
Sounds very festive, and I'm thinking how wonderful it must be as the music director and conductor of the symphony to have the hall, the beautiful Orpheum, the amazing acoustics, Zua Bailey, and the Wurlitzer organ. I mean, my gosh.
Christmas come early, right? I mean, what more could I wish for? Yeah, it's going to be a wonderful night, and lots of audience participation. I know, Gretchen, you've already
the
started
sing-along.
Warming up this week.
Yes.
I've heard you down the street warming up, and it's going to be wonderful popular tunes and carols mixed into those sing-alongs, and a reading, of course, by Al Jones from Channel 4, Twas Night Before Christmas, some other special guests. So it's just going to be a lovely, lovely evening.
And so could you talk a little bit about your career? And I know you've been doing a number of recordings. Have you recorded the Elgar?
I did. I did it a few years ago with, who did I do that with? The Indianapolis Symphony. And it was a live recording. Yes, and I just did the Schumann Concerto last month with the Philharmonia in London. The cello repertoire is wonderfully compact. Most of the great composers wrote something for the cello, and I've been very lucky to explore them, and I've kind of slogged through them over the past 15 or 17 years to record them for these projects. And I'm getting to the place now where I'm going to find new or commission new works, do new things, because unlike the piano, to get through the piano repertoire, you have to specialize. You play Mozart, or you were a Russian pianist, or you're Bach-centric or whatnot. I've been able to go through the repertoire, spend a great deal of time with the great masterpieces like Schumann and Elgar and Dvorak and these, and I get to keep revisiting them. Recordings to me are snapshots in time. I try not to listen to them after I do them because it is exactly where I was at that given moment. But preparing for such a document is quite a grueling path because you know it's forever whether you like it or not.
And most recently, speaking of commissions, part of your trophy case now represents some most recent collaboration with Michael Dougherty.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, sure. Michael Dougherty wrote, and just recently I've had all these wonderful opportunities with living composers. Michael Dougherty wrote a cello concerto for me a few years ago called Tales of Hemingway, and it won 3 Grammy Awards. It was an experience that I'd never had before, again, working hand in hand with the composer, having the premiere performance be the recording, having the excitement and the adrenaline of seeing a composer be flexible and adjust and not be so what you think they would be, rigid, and this is the way it has to be, and that's the way I hear it, and inspired. It was a great process. And right now, Ellen Zwillick is writing me a cello concerto to be premiered next season. So basically I'm trying to make sound investments for the future, with, you know, not just celebrating the past, but trying to see what will stick for the future. If we didn't have Rostropovich, we would be 170 new works down. He was basically a part of 170 new works in his lifetime, which included Prokofiev and Shostakovich and Piazzolla and all of these people. And we have to use that as an example to continue to invest in the future.
Could you talk about your cellos? You have a primary cello, but actually you have multiple cellos.
A funny story is that I travel with this cello and I buy a seat for it on the airplanes, the cello that I use, my primary instrument.
Does it have a name? Sometimes they name them, right? Do you have a name for the job? Okay, I guess not. We're not going to discuss the name. Yeah.
Is there a name? Are you that rumor that the mistake that I made a long time ago? Okay. That shows that you can't get rid of what you say in the media. So, I'll come back to that. So I also don't put it in the trunk of a car because it's a special cello. So it's always on my lap. I was in New York City late at night in the Bronx and coming back. And the taxi cab driver stopped the car in the middle of nowhere under a bridge and opened the glass and said, "So, hey, buddy, what's in the box?" And I said, "Oh, sir, this is a cello." He goes, "How much is that thing worth?" And I didn't flinch. I said, "Not very much. It's used." And he goes, "Oh." And I kind of realized at that moment I defused a bomb. At the same time, it's a joke because it's so used because it's built in 1693 as basically a church base. It's shaped like a pear. So the joke back 17 years ago, I was
You're welcome for this,
yeah, thank
by the
you.
Way.
Thank you. I was on an airplane and they made me name my cello. They have to have a name for the ticket. So I said, "Well, it's shaped like a pear, so it's named J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez." So I thought at the time it was funny. It sort of was funny. And then it got repeated over and over and over and over.
And once more today.
And one more today. So that was 2000, I think it was the year 2000 that I said that. And so I don't use that, though. I've been thinking about naming, it's got a rose carved on the front. So either the rose or the rosette cello or something that's signifying. It's one of two that has this carving on the front. So I've been contemplating a name for it other than just the ex Misha Schneider, who was the man who had it before me.
And talk a little bit more about the history of the cello.
It was made in Venice, Italy in 1693 by a man named Matteo Goffriller. Goffriller does not sound Italian. It's a German last name, but he was an Italian man, so was his family. Of course, Matteo is an Italian name. And he's very renowned for his cellos. In fact, not just because I have one, but I would say that if you gave the choice of any cellos on earth for cellists to choose from, they would either choose Goffriller's or Montagnana. Montagnana was the student of Goffriller. These Venetian, earthy, just visceral instruments are what people gravitate towards, even more so than Stradivariuses, because they've got this extra claws that come in them. But there are very few of them, and they only come up for acquisition. I mean, I was one of three people in 100 years to play it, and I've had it for 21 years now. So
how does one acquire the privilege of playing an instrument of this?
That's a great question, and I'm certainly asked this all the time. How did you get it? How'd you get it? If I were born, so I'm 46 years old. If I were born 10 years or 15 years earlier, I could have mortgaged this instrument. I could have taken out a mortgage and gotten it and paid it off over 30 years. From what I've read and been told, in the early 1980s, these tools became works of art from the luthiers and the sellers of them. So in the 80s, they just start skyrocketing in pieces of art, priceless pieces of art. So people of my generation couldn't do it because getting out of school with technically no secure job for the whatever foreseeable future. I mean, as technically as a soloist, I have a job. I have one gig after another. You can't borrow it either. So to answer your question, at 25, I borrowed the cello in a random concert, and I met an angel, a sponsor, who bought it for my lifetime use. So that's the only way I could have gotten it. If I tried to pay it back, it would have decimated my life the last 25 years to try to pay it back. Mm-hmm. At the price that was properly paid for it back then. So it's a real gift. And most people in my position are in that same situation. It's a loan from a society or a museum or these kinds of things, unless they come from the family has some kind of connections with money.
Well, with the characteristics of this instrument, and it music of the Baroque, early music, all the way through contemporary music, translates beautifully on this instrument. How do you explain that?
Well, the cello's been adjusted since 1693. There's a higher bridge. The angle of the fingerboard is greater, so it has a bigger sound. There's a new bow. The modern bow was basically invented in the 1700s, so it would have been a Baroque bow back in 1600s. There was no end pin on the cello back in the 1600s, so it's free standing as opposed to being suffocated with the knees of holding it like an early cellist would. It's a big beast of a cello. Playing Vivaldi and Schubert on it is a struggle because it just doesn't spin like bells. But playing Brahms and Beethoven and you know groveling through the imperfections of life in these pieces, it certainly has it in spades. I mean, you can hear the phlegm in the voice of it. You can hear the growl and the extra wood because it's bigger than most cellos. Most cellos after mine were cut down. Because Stradivarius decided that the shape of the cello should emulate a tenor-like voice versus a baritone or a bass. That's when the cello started having melodious roles in ensembles. And most of the earlier makes were cut down to copy Stradivarius' success at a smaller cello. And that rose on the top of my cello prohibited mine from being cut down, because the way you cut down a cello is you take out a strip out of the center and then you make it smaller. Like a paint stirrer strip. And mine, right where that thing would have been, was that medallion, beautiful stained glass windowy thing called a rosette that saved it. So this is what makes it so unique. And when you hear it, you go, oh, even I, when I hear it on the radio sometime, I, well, there's my cello right there, before they tell who it is after like three notes. It's like, I jokingly say, it's like hearing James Earl Jones's voice. You know immediately that was who it is.
Will you record the Bach cello suites? I love those.
I have.
What is the label of your recordings?
Telarc. Telarc. I did about 8 or 9 records for CDs. Then I moved over to Steinway & Sons because I'd done some projects with them. And I moved the Telarc recording team, which is super audio, over to Steinway with me. So I've been working with the same team for about 15 years now. But most of my recordings are, actually the core repertoire is on Telarc, and the last maybe 5 are on Steinway & Sons.
Okay. Well, I will be looking into the cello suites.
Yeah.
I love those, especially, of course, the first one.
Yeah, I do too.
So soulful.
It's genuine and innocent, and this makes everything okay.
Can you tell us a little story we were talking about when you went to Alaska? Because your cello that you've been talking about isn't as adaptable in all weather situations.
Mm-hmm. You, before the mics went on, you asked how many cellos I have, and I said, I have this one. This is my primary instrument, but I have others that are tools to make music more accessible. And I say that because, let's just start with the fact that when I go into a school, I like to have the children be able to touch the cello. So I have a carbon fiber instrument that is indestructible. And so they can even play it. I don't mind them. They can't hurt it. And I have a lesser quality wooden cello also that still has the fibrous warmth of wood that also doesn't, it wouldn't be jeopardized in temperature. Going to places like Alaska, because I'm picked up and there's still a moment where I walk outside of the plane to my car and it's 40 below zero. And if you've ever stood in 40 below zero before, it feels okay for about 6 seconds. And then you start violently shaking and, you know, the wood, it's just going to crack. But I do enjoy the aspect of taking these instruments. And quite frankly, interestingly, young people are as excited to see a carbon fiber cello as they are a historic cello, because it's more like Batman's car or, you know, their surfboard or whatever. It's really accessible. So it's fun.
Well, one of the things that I appreciate about Ryan Haskins is his mission to take music into the schools and reach out to children who I'm guessing most have never really had an opportunity to even be close to a cello or an instrument and experience that.
Yeah, I mean, that this is an unfortunate reality, I think, for a lot of orchestras, is everyone always assumes, you know, the primary work is on stage. And that's not even thinking about rehearsals in preparation for those concerts. But the truth of it is, with any great orchestra or responsible orchestra, maybe more specifically, is that there are a lot of behind-the-scenes projects that are always churning. You know, we do just about 40 performances in school for 6th through 8th graders with our ensembles in the schools. That's woodwinds, brass, and strings. We also now have an accelerated program in the Orpheum, where now we're serving just under 11,000 children in every year, 3rd through 5th graders who come into the Orpheum for those live performances. And we're also now taking our principals into the high schools, which is a new program where they go in and coach. They work with an orchestra or work with a section or prep some of the high schoolers for solo and ensemble. So now we have, you know, first time in our history, 3rd through high school, some interaction and some ability to be a part of a young person's upbringing in music. And that's not to say that all of them will go on into, you know, big music careers. Some may, and it's absolutely possible, and I hope it is the fact that some of these young people will be the next generation of the Sioux City Symphony. That's the hope, of course. But it also adds to, and I'm sure Zul would agree, that, you know, these types of developmental aspects that we provide through music allow young people to dream and to see worlds outside of what they only can experience in their homes or in their hometown. You know, I'm sure Zul has experienced that in some remote areas in Alaska or wherever, you know, where someone might not have the opportunity to travel or to be outside of what they know. But music brings this element that a young person, and it's always young people can do it much better than us, I think, can close their eyes and disappear in a moment's time and be in the middle of Venice or be in the middle of Berlin at a difficult, you know, challenge in Berlin or celebrating something in early America. I mean, all of these moments can be defined without words, and it's always the children who get that much quicker than we do. So to be a part of that and to be an inspirational part of that on every level is vital.
I tell communities that the true cultural heartbeat of any community is the symphony, not just for what he just described in all the school concerts, but the symphony represents all of the musicians in town that get together to be inspired by Ryan and this music, and they get their tanks refilled to then go and do the groundwork daily in their schools, because most of these orchestras everywhere, everybody teaches privately, they teach in public schools, they teach in private schools, and this celebration, the filling the gas tank, happens at the concerts, where they get to be reminded that this high experience, and it's exciting to watch. But people can't forget that's the celebration that was led up to by all of this other stuff, and it takes all of it to make a community work.
Well, we're very proud of our symphony. We're very proud and privileged to have a brilliant young music director and conductor, and someone that I have thoroughly enjoyed working with and have learned so much about music. So it's a great partnership here at Siouxland Public Media, KWIT, KOJI, and truly Zul Bailey, for me, Gretchen, the interview of a lifetime.
Thank you so very much.
And I know that you have to get going. We want to thank Ryan Haskins. And again, could you run over the particulars for tomorrow night?
Yes, tomorrow concert begins at 7:30 p.m. A pre-concert concert on the Mighty World, sir, at 6:45. And tickets are still available. less and less as we get closer to the hour, but do call in at 712-277-2111 or visit our website at siouxcitysymphony.org. And see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Ryan, very much, and good luck tomorrow night. Zoe Bailey, great pleasure. I hope you will come back many times.
Thank you. See you tomorrow night.
Thank you.